Torvin's smile did not waver, but something shifted behind his eyes, a flicker of irritation quickly masked by boredom. He raised a hand, and the soldiers behind him fanned out, their boots squelching in the wet grass as they moved into position. Spears lowered, shields locked, the disciplined movement of men who had done this before. Ilse did not flinch. She kept her hand on the waystone, feeling the cold seep through her palm, feeling the hum vibrate up her arm and into her shoulder, a frequency so low it was more sensation than sound. Behind her, the villagers shifted uneasily, some 30 farmers with pitchforks and scythes and a rusted musket. They were brave, she knew that, but bravery did not stop Steele. "Mrs. Vane," Torvin called again, his voice carrying across the field. "Step away from the stone. I am not interested in hurting you. I am interested in the stones, nothing more." "You took one already," Il said. Her voice was flat, factual. "The second one, you struck it with iron wedges and a sledgehammer. You left a jagged stump." Torvin shrugged. "A rock is a rock. The Baron needs building stone. Your uncle's sentimentality is not my concern." "My uncle is dead," Il said. "And these stones are not rocks. They are the only thing keeping the dark from consuming this valley. If you remove them, you are not building a hall. You are opening a wound." "My uncle is dead," Il said. She pressed her palm flat against the stone, feeling the cold bite through her skin. "Take them and you take the road. Take the road and you take everything past it." Torvin's expression hardened. He had heard this speech before, or something like it. He had dismissed it before. He would dismiss it again. "Your uncle's stories won't fill my barns. There is nothing on this road but weeds and cold stone." Torvin considered this. She saw the calculation behind his eyes, the way he weighed the risk against the reward. He was a bureaucrat, not a warrior. He preferred leverage to violence, paperwork to bloodshed. But he was also impatient, and the Baron's orders were clear. The stones needed to come down. "No," he said finally. "I will not waste men on your fantasy. Move aside, Mrs. Vane. This is your last warning." Ilse did not move. Behind her, Bess adjusted her grip on the scythe, her knuckles white. The old man with the musket pointed it uncertainly at the ground, his hands shaking. Ilse felt the fear rippling through them, a wave of panic threatening to break the fragile line they had formed. She needed to hold them together. She needed to hold the road. "Jaren," she said without turning around, "tell them." Jaren stepped forward from behind the group. He had been quiet since they assembled, his face pale, his body swaying slightly with exhaustion. He had walked the road since dawn, past the broken waystones, past the places where the dark had already touched the earth. He looked like a man who had seen the end of the world and was still walking toward it. "There is nothing between us and the northern shore," Jaren said. His voice was quiet, but it carried. It was the voice of a man who had nothing left to lose and everything to say. "The third waystone is gone, not broken, not struck, gone as if it had never been there, and behind it the dark, it moves. It does not hunt flesh, it hunts memory, it eats connection, it leaves shells. Empty shells walking around in the world, forgetting who they are, forgetting who they loved, forgetting why they breathe." No one answered. The soldiers looked at each other. Some of them frowned, confusion creasing their faces. One of them, a young man with a scar across his cheek, opened his mouth to speak, then closed it again. He looked lost. "You're lying," Torvin said, but his voice lacked conviction. He looked at his soldiers, at their uneasy faces, at the way they shifted their weight from foot to foot. He saw the doubt spreading among them, the same doubt that had taken root in his own chest. "Jaren said, query your men. Tell them to remember when birds last sang upon the road. Tell them to recall when warmth ever touched the hollow. Tell them to remember why they stand here today." Silence. The soldiers looked at each other. Some of them frowned, confusion creasing their faces. One of them, a young man with a scar across his cheek, opened his mouth to speak, then closed it again. He looked lost. Torvin's jaw tightened. He was losing control. He could feel it, the way a man feels water rising around his ankles when he has been standing in a flooded room too long. He needed to act. He needed to break this moment before it broke him. "Seize her," he said. The soldiers moved. Ilse felt the villagers behind her surge forward, pitchforks raised, scythes swinging, the rusted musket barking a single shot that went wild and ricocheted off stone. Chaos erupted. Shouts, curses, the clash of wood on shield, the cry of a horse startled by the noise. Ilse did not join the fray. She kept her hand on the waystone, she closed her eyes, and she sang. Not a song she knew, not a melody or a rhyme, something older, something deeper. A sound that rose from the bottom of her chest and traveled up through her throat and into the stone, a vibration that matched the hum of the waystone and amplified it, doubling it, tripling it, until the air itself seemed to tremble. The villagers stopped fighting. The soldiers stopped advancing. Even Torvin froze, his hand halfway drawn from his sword, his eyes wide with something that was not quite fear but close to it. The hum grew louder. The waystone beneath Ilse's hand vibrated violently, the cold intensifying until it burned her palm. The air above the stone shimmered, a distortion like heat rising from summer pavement, but the air was freezing. Frost crept across the cobbles, spreading outward from the stone in delicate, crystalline patterns. And then, from the north, came a sound. It was not a roar, not a scream, not the thunder of approaching storm. It was silence. Absolute, crushing silence, moving toward them like a tide swallowing sound as it went. The birds stopped singing. The wind stopped blowing. The villagers stopped breathing. Even the horses went still, their heads lowered, their ears pinned back, their bodies trembling. The dark was here. Ilse opened her eyes. She could not see it, not really. It had no shape, no form, no color. It was simply the absence of everything, a void moving through the world, erasing as it went. Where it touched the grass turned gray and brittle. Where it touched the air went cold and still. She sang louder. The hum answered. The waystone vibrated beneath her hand, the cold intensifying, the frost spreading faster. Behind her, she felt the villagers gathering, their fear transforming into something else, something fierce and desperate and utterly determined. Bess stepped up beside her, her scythe lowered, her hands pressing against the stone. Then another villager. Then another. 30 hands on the waystone, 30 voices joining hers in a sound that was not quite a song but close to it, a collective hum that rose from the earth and met the dark head-on. The dark hesitated. It was not a retreat. It was a pause, a moment of uncertainty, as if the void itself was unsure whether to push forward or pull back. The silence wavered. The cold intensified. The frost spread across the road, covering the cracked stones in a layer of ice that glittered dully in the gray light. Torvin stared at it. He was a man of facts and figures, of ledgers and contracts and property deeds. He did not believe in fairy tales. He did not believe in dark that ate memory. But he was standing on the edge of something he could not comprehend, something that defied every rational explanation he had ever encountered, and his mind offered no counsel. "Retreat," he said. His voice was quiet, almost swallowed by the silence. "Fall back." His soldiers did not need to be told twice. They turned and ran, their boots slipping on the ice, their shields clattering against their backs, their spears abandoned in the wet grass. Torvin mounted his horse and spurred it into a gallop, disappearing over the rise, his banner snapping behind him like a wound. The villagers watched him go. They did not cheer. They did not celebrate. They stood in silence, their hands still on the stone, their breath coming in shallow gasps, their bodies trembling with adrenaline and fear and something that might have been awe. Il stopped singing. The hum faded slowly, reluctantly, the way a sound fades when it is not being fed. The frost on the road began to melt, dripping from the stones in slow, icy tears. The gray grass slowly regained its color, though it remained brittle and lifeless. The birds did not return to singing. The wind did not return to blowing. But the dark receded. Slowly, reluctantly, pulling back into the north, into the hollow, into the places where the waystones had fallen and the road was broken. Ilse let her hand drop from the stone. Her palm was numb, her fingers stiff with cold. She looked at the villagers. They looked at her. 30 farmers. 30 people who had just witnessed something they could not explain and would never fully understand. "We cannot hold it forever," she said. Her voice was hoarse, scraped raw from the singing. "The stones are failing. Torvin will come back. The Baron will send more men. And the dark will not stop. It will keep coming, until we either seal the road or we sing it back." Bess wiped her mouth with the back of her hand. Her face was pale, her eyes wide. "How many stones are left?" Ilse counted. She had felt them. She had sung to them. She knew which ones were still standing and which ones were gone. "Five," she said. "Maybe six, if the fourth is still intact." "Where is the fourth?" "Past the northern hollow, near the old bridge." Ilse looked north, toward the mist, toward the places where the dark had already touched the earth. "Jaren went there this morning. He has not returned." A silence fell over the square. It was not the peaceful silence of a winter evening. It was the heavy, suffocating silence of a held breath. "Then we wait," Bess said finally, "and we prepare. Whatever comes next, we prepare." Ilse nodded. She turned and walked back toward the cottage, her boots crunching on the melting ice, her body aching with exhaustion, her mind racing with possibilities and consequences, and the terrible weight of the choice she would have to make. Inside, Alara lay on the pallet, her small body twitching as if she were running through dreams. Her breathing was shallow and rapid, each inhalation a struggle, each exhalation a whistle that sounded like air escaping a broken vessel. Jaren sat beside her, his hand resting lightly on her forehead, his expression unreadable. "She's burning up," he said quietly. "The fever is worse." Ilse knelt beside the pallet. She pressed her palm to her daughter's forehead. The heat was intense, almost unbearable. She looked at Jaren. She looked at Alara. She looked at the door. "I need to go to Marrow's Ford," she said. "The healer, 6 or 7 miles, I need medicine." Jaren shook his head. "You're not going anywhere, not like this, not after what just happened." "I have to. She'll die if I don't." "Then I'll go." Ilse looked at him. He was exhausted, bruised, shaking. He had walked the road since dawn, past the broken waystones, past the places where the shadows were beginning to lengthen across the cracked stones. He was no good to anyone if he collapsed on the road. "You're no use to me dead," she said. "I'm no use to her either if you die trying to reach Marrow's Ford alone." Jaren's voice was firm, resolute, the voice of a man who had made his decision and would not be dissuaded. "I know the road. I know the way. I'll go." Ilse hesitated. She wanted to argue. She wanted to insist. But she was tired. She was cold. She was terrified. And she was running out of options. "Take the ledger," she said finally. "Take the dried herbs. Take the copper coins. And if you see the dark, don't fight it. Run." He dipped his chin in assent, then rose, his frame unsteady as he snatched his cloak from the hook near the door. At the threshold, he lingered, turning his gaze back to her. "Come back," he said, "both of us." Ilse did not answer. She watched him go. She watched him walk toward the road, his figure disappearing into the mist, his footsteps fading into the silence. She turned back to Alara. She pressed her daughter's hand to her chest, feeling the frantic beat of her heart, feeling the fragile warmth of her small body, feeling the love that was the only thing stronger than fear. Outside, the wind carried the faintest vibration from the hollow, a sound so low it might have been nothing at all. But Ilse heard it. She heard the hum of the stones, she heard the silence between them, and she heard, beneath it all, the sound of something moving. Slow, deliberate, inexorable. She closed her eyes, letting the draft pass through, waiting for the wind to break.